Tatamvitam Istam Sajivam. Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam. Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakam Vitamscha. Panchakalpa Chubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhye Bacha Patitanam Pavana Evyo Vaishnavevyo Namo Namaha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. February 22nd, 2016, Skype class over from Hilo, Hawaii, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 9, Brahma's Prayers for Creative Energy, Text 39.
Oh, is it
38? No, 38, sorry, 38, my mistake, 38. You can take us back there, sorry, my mistake. I had on my screen the Veda base and it showed the end of 38 and the beginning of 39. Yachatanga matstotram. Matkata byudayankitam. Yatvatapa site nista. Sa esha maranugraha. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. O Brahma, the prayers that you have chanted praising the glories of my transcendental activities, the penances you have undertaken to understand me, and your firm faith in me, all these are to be considered my causeless mercy. Purport. When a living entity desires to serve the Lord in transcendental loving service, the Lord helps the devotee in so many ways as the Chaitya Guru, or the spiritual master within, and thus the devotee can perform many wonderful activities beyond material estimation. By the mercy of the Lord, even a layman can compose prayers of the highest spiritual perfection. Such spiritual perfection is not limited by material qualifications, but is developed by dint of one's sincere endeavor to render transcendental service. Voluntary endeavor is the only qualification for spiritual perfection. Material acquisitions of wealth or education are not considered. Yatschakar tangamatstotram matkatam byudayankitam yadva tapasite nishtasa esa maranugraha. O Brahma, the prayers that you have chanted praising the glories of my transcendental activities, the penances you have undertaken to understand me, and your firm faith in me, all these are to be considered my causeless mercy. So Prabhupada says here, voluntary endeavor is the only qualification for spiritual perfection. You know, we often want to know what is the secret, right? You know, what is the key? And we'll get to different answers. We say, well, and we've talked about these at other times. Well, it's the association of devotees, right? It's the chanting of the holy name. Those are all correct answers. It's not that any of them are incorrect answers. But if we want to find the secret, here is at least one of those secrets. Voluntary endeavor. Voluntary endeavor is the only qualification. I mean, it's even interesting when you think about qualification, because Srila Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu says the only qualification is taste. The only qualification is some feeling of pleasure in the service of the Lord. He says all you need to do to start bhakti is to have some taste for it. And then when Rupa Goswami talks about the different kinds of adhikar, or qualification, for starting Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, which is generally people start with Vaidhi Sadhana Bhakti, some rare exceptions perhaps, but Vaidhi is according to the vidhi, according to the rules. Whoever's typing probably should mute themselves because we can hear the typing. So the qualifications for starting Vaidhi Bhakti, faith in following the rules is, well, it's faith in the rules. So Rupa Goswami says someone who has a small amount of faith, someone whose faith is easily disturbed by others and who cannot convince others, has the minimum qualification. Someone whose faith is not easily disturbed by others, but who may not be able to convince others, has a medium qualification. And one whose faith is not easily disturbed by others and who can convince others has the greatest qualification. So Rupa Goswami talks about qualification in terms of taste and in terms of faith. And here Srila Prabhupada is saying voluntary endeavor is the only qualification. Of course, all of those go together. And they're really, you're just looking at the situation from different angles of vision. And of course, voluntary endeavor to do what? Well, you're voluntarily going to endeavor to associate with devotees, you're going to voluntarily endeavor to chant Hare Krishna, you're going to voluntarily endeavor to read the scriptures and so forth. So it's all together. But we're wondering why here Srila Prabhupada is focusing on voluntary endeavor. And it actually reminds us very much of Prabhupada's phrase, devotional service. Endeavor is the service, devotion is the voluntary part. Anyway, let's go through this purport and see what is the key to advancing in Krishna consciousness. What's the thing I have to have, you know? We so often, if I could only do this, if I could only do that, if I could only arrange my life this way, if I could only arrange my life that way, right, then I'd be able to make spiritual advancement. And here it's a question of our voluntary endeavor only. All right, let's go through the purport. Be nice if you could, Ramananda, scroll down on the screen, so instead of just seeing the Sanskrit, if we could see that it's a short purport. Yeah, there you go. Show us the translation purport. Very, very nice. So Prabhupada talks about here, when a living entity desires to serve the Lord in transcendental loving service. So this is the first thing he mentions. So living entity, we are alive. A dead thing, right? This is it. Like cartels, so this can't have a desire, right? I can't say to these, do you want me to play you today? Whatever I want to do with it. You know, I have a pen, but I don't say to the pen, well, do you want me to write with you today? I just tell it to write, and as long as there's ink in there, it won't write. So living entity, we have to be alive. To be a living entity means we have a personality, means we have likes and dislikes. It means that there's certain ways that we're comfortable and certain ways that we're uncomfortable. It means there's certain things that we're good at. I was recently reading in a book on sociology a definition of our talents as something that we're just naturally good at without even thinking about it. It's something like breathing. We do it without even knowing we're doing it. Other people see it as a talent and we just see it as natural. And we will do it automatically whether we get paid or not. And each of us has something different for that. So that's all living entity. And such is true even when the living entity is embodied. Even when the living entity is embodied in a plant form, one can still discern individuality. Desires. So desires is a function of a living entity. Right? It's like matter cannot desire. I, a living entity, can have a desire. I'm about to take one of my grandchildren traveling with me when I go on a preaching tour, and one of the younger grandchildren says, well, I don't want to travel. So there's desires. One person may say, I want to travel. Another person may say, I don't want to travel. Some person may say, you know, I want to go to big events. I want to go to birthday parties and weddings. And someone else says, oh, I don't like big events. I don't like big crowds. I'd rather stay home. So we have different desires. And these desires, of course, materially, are things of thinking how we can fulfill our sense gratification, how I can fulfill my own need for pleasure and peace and so forth. That's what we call material desires, that I'm thinking, how am I going to be pleased? But here, desires to serve the Lord in transcendental loving service. Well, that was very interesting. I had a fascinating talk, chat really, electronic chat with one leading preacher a few days ago. And he was showing me some other devotees writing about the superiority and inferiority, the higher and lower status of different residents of Vrindavan. And the person who was posting the material we were looking at had done extensive quoting from the Shastra and from the Acharyas, but their main point was that the Manjari gopis are higher because they taste a higher kind of pleasure. That the Manjari gopis, by not desiring to be with Krishna directly, but rather facilitating Radharani's being with Krishna, that the Manjari gopis tasted a higher pleasure than the gopis who wanted to be with Krishna directly. So this preacher that was bringing this up to me said, I realized that these sort of things are really talking about the pleasure of the jiva. He said, when they say tasting a higher pleasure, he said, they're not asking whose pleasure. Whose pleasure are we talking about? Are we talking about the jiva's pleasure or Krishna's pleasure, Radharani's pleasure? So desires to serve the Lord in transcendental loving service, that means having a desire to please the Lord. And if we think, well, that's, you know, way too high up in the sky for me, we have desires to please other living beings without wanting something in return on a regular basis, where we feel that their happiness is our happiness. And those of us who have children know this feeling very well. The parents are, generally, most parents, they are happy when their children are happy and they don't need anything in return. You know, when your little child is smiling and happy and playing, it doesn't, they're not giving you something, but just seeing that they're happily playing, you feel happy. Just seeing that your child has accomplished something, then you feel happy. So we all have this experience. We have this experience with our friends, with our spouse, with our associates, that we feel happy for their happiness. And this is one of the reasons people watch sporting events, that they take pleasure in the win of somebody else. Right? That has really nothing to do with them at all. And the benefit that they get for themselves, they don't get any benefit for themselves. What benefit do they get for themselves? So you're watching the sporting event, you know, in person or on television, and your team wins, and you're celebrating that they've won, and it's exhilarating. People feel exhilarated by it. And they feel happier often than if they went and won something. So this is this concept that we gain more happiness by giving than by getting, and that we can serve others for the purpose of their happiness, that we take our happiness vicariously through them, because we have some sort of affection or attachment for them, is something that all of us experience all the time. Of course, in the material world, this is not pure. So there's, even if we're not, literally getting something, I mean, the football fan doesn't, on a gross level, get anything unless they're gambling on the game. They're not literally getting anything. They're not getting any higher status or money or anything from their team winning. And the parent isn't getting anything from the child playing happily, maybe some moments of peace, one could say. But still there's some selfish element to it. It's not entirely selfless. And the thing that drives our vicarious happiness is feeling that we are connected to that other living being or living beings in some way, that they are the whole of which we are a part. And on a material level, that's not really true. I'm not really part of my particular family or my sports team or my country or anything like that. So it's not exactly spiritual, but it gives us some idea. So when the devotee comes to the understanding that I really am a part of Krishna, I really am a part of the whole, Krishna is the self of the self, he is the Paramatma, and when I serve the self of the self, that is the best way for me to be happy. And one eventually forgets about one's own happiness. One may start out by saying, well, if I serve Krishna, I'll achieve the highest happiness. But eventually one just simply wants Krishna to be happy. So having any desire for this, when we have any desire, this is talking again about some sort of taste, to serve the Lord in transcendental loving service, transcendental, above the material, then the Lord helps the devotees in so many ways. So whatever we need is given by the Lord. Even the ability to offer prayers, the ability to do what can be wonderful and amazing activities. I mean, how can we say from a material level, we have a 70-year-old man goes to a foreign country with no money and no friends. He speaks the language with a very heavy accent, and he sits down under a tree in a park and plays music. simple music, not concert music, just with a pair of hand cymbals. And from that, he gets, nearly 5,000 disciples in 11 years. So that's, as Prabhupada will say here, right, something, wonderful activities beyond material estimation. There's, you can't explain that materially. It doesn't really make any sense from a material point of view. You know, if you want to start a movement, then you have money, you have connections or something like that. You have some material talent that's attracting people. But Prabhupada wasn't, it wasn't like he was some sort of stage musician, with some honeyed trained voice playing amazing riffs on the guitar. It wasn't something like that. So we see that those who are even not such exalted devotees as Srila Prabhupada, that they can do amazing things. Just like Srila Prabhupada told the devotees in the early days of the movement, go start a magazine. And they said, well, we don't know how to start a magazine, Prabhupada. We've never started a magazine. And Prabhupada said, Krishna will help you. Or the time that Srila Prabhupada said to the devotees, you've gotten behind me in publishing. I'm translating faster than you're publishing. And the devotees told Prabhupada, it takes us 2 to 4 months to publish one book. Prabhupada said, how many books are we behind? The devotee says, 17 books. Prabhupada says, you publish all 17 books in 2 months, and they did it. And Rameshwar said to Srila Prabhupada, that's impossible. And Prabhupada said, impossible is a word in a fool's dictionary. Even just going to India and places like Vrindavan, Mayapur in South India, and having the foreigners accepted as bona fide Vaishnavas, practically impossible. I mean, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati, there was a death threat against him because he was giving Brahminical initiation to Indians born in non-Brahmin families. And here his disciple, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, was giving Brahminical initiation to men and women from all over the world, not just non-Brahmin families. And amazing that they were accepted by the society. Not at first, of course. At first there was a lot of resistance, but eventually the devotees were accepted as bona fide devotees. So what we need to do in order to do amazing activities beyond material estimation is we have to listen to the Lord within. So that's the next point here. For the first point Prabhupada makes is we have to have a desire to please the Lord's senses. We have to have not to use the Lord. Anya bilasita sunyam. If we're desiring to use the Lord, let me go to the Lord so that he'll give me money and he'll give me, good health, or he'll give me a beautiful home by the sea, Jai Jagadish Hari. If we're going to the Lord for that purpose, that's not what we're talking about. But we're going to the Lord, at least with a desire to please the Lord. And then we listen to the Lord. We listen to the super soul in our heart. And everybody always asks the question, how do you know if it's the super soul or the mind? Well, first of all, there's a great qualitative difference between the super soul and the mind, like the difference between freshly squeezed, locally grown organic orange juice and some chemically orange flavored sugar water. So there's a big qualitative difference, but also anything that we understand is being said by the Chaita Guru is going to be confirmed by the Shastra. It's going to be confirmed by the sadhus. It's going to be confirmed by the external guru. There's a check and balance there. But the point is that we have to listen. And listen means, like Prabhupada said, get me some water, and someone will sit there and do nothing. Did you hear me? Oh, yes, I heard you, Srila Prabhupada. So why are you still sitting there? Well, I heard you. So hearing means to act upon. It means to understand. It means to assimilate. It means to make it part of oneself. And when the Lord in the heart gives some indication, whether through little whisperings in the heart, or whether through reading something in the Shastra, or whether through somebody else speaking to one, I mean, Srila Prabhupada tells the story of how just some ordinary person, when Prabhupada was out distributing Back to Godhead magazines, just some ordinary person said to him, "Why are you selling magazines that people will throw away? Why don't you produce books?" And Prabhupada, "Oh, that is Krishna speaking through this person." And prayers. We should actually go, before we go to prayers, performing many wonderful activities beyond material estimation. So if when we desire to please the Lord, and when we listen to the Lord in the heart, then we become empowered. As Srila Prabhupada was empowered, as the devotees on the BBT were empowered. We become empowered. And then we have to remember that we are empowered. It's not our power. It's not our power. You know, if we take some device, you know, I have a recording device here, and it has a little battery, but if I don't plug it in periodically, then the battery will not work. So if the recording device thinks, "Oh, I'm so powerful," and isn't plugged in, then its very limited power will be extinguished very quickly. So when Krishna empowers us to do these many wonderful things beyond understanding, we always remember, and this has been discussed in the previous verses, that the power is not ours. It is borrowed power. And just like Arjuna at the end of the Lord's manifest pastimes, he didn't have the power. He couldn't even string his great Gandiva bow. So I really like the Christian writer C.S. Lewis in Screwtape Letters. He talks about that a person properly in this understanding is astonished at his own activities in a similar way as he's astonished at someone else's activities. He doesn't think of himself as the doer. So we appreciate, wow, that devotee has done something wonderful. And if Krishna empowers me to do something wonderful, I just see it like that. Wow. You know, Krishna has empowered that devotee. Krishna has empowered me. It's all Krishna's power. We're standing back as an instrument and observing how wonderfully Krishna is using us. I remember an experience very soon after I moved into a temple ashram. I used to go out to O'Hare Airport in Chicago and sell Srila Prabhupada's books to the public. On Saturday, we didn't go to the airport. There weren't, in those days at least, there weren't very many people traveling on a Saturday night. I doubt if that's true anymore. But anyway, the airport was pretty empty, and we would instead chant out on the streets, do Harinam Sankirtan. So we were all out in the party doing Harinam Sankirtan, and one of the devotees, Mahamuni Prabhu, said, "Who would like to go to the airport?" "Who would like to go to the airport?" So I said, "Okay, I'd like to go." So we took a bus and we went to the airport. And on the way, on the bus, he was talking about how many books he would distribute. So I was never one of those, you know, big distributors. And as I was listening to him, I was thinking, wow, you know, I've never distributed that many books in that amount of time. So I got into a little bit of a competitive mood, and I thought, I'm going to distribute more books than him. And we got there, and as typical on a Saturday night, there weren't very many people in the airport. It was pretty empty. I mean, quite literally, we were there for 2 hours, and quite literally, there was only a person to approach every 10 or 15 minutes. The terminal was just empty. So I was just praying like crazy, you know. Of course, I had some competitive desire to beat Mahamuni's score. But anyway, I was just praying like crazy that I would distribute a lot of books. And I had such amazing experience that there weren't very many people to approach. Generally, when you're out on book distribution, only maybe one out of every 100 or 200 people even stop. So you got all these people coming at you. Try to go up to them, "Would you take a book?" And most of them just, "No, thank you, no, thank you." Or they don't say anything and they just walk past. And occasionally someone stops and listens to what you have to say. Well, that night, every single person I went up to, and again, there weren't very many, they each stopped and heard what I had to say. Then again, generally on distribution, of all the people who stop and listen to what you have to say, only a very small fraction of them take a book, like Manusinam Sahasresu Kashtir Yadati Siddhayadatamapi Siddhanam Kashtir Mam Vesitad Futaha. But on that night, every single person who I could have approached, I did. All of those people stopped and listened, and all of those people took books. And not only did each of those people take books, but they each took a lot of books. They gave very large donations. So at the end of those 2 hours, I had distributed more books and collected more donations than I had normally done in 6 or 8 hours at the airport, and I had far surpassed Mahamuni's score. But I didn't have this mood. Even I had just moved into the ashram a few months previously. I don't think I was initiated at that time. But I was very aware that I was being empowered. In fact, when I would speak to people, I often wasn't even fully aware of what I said to the person. It was like there was just words coming out of my mouth that weren't my words, and I was sort of observing and listening to myself speak. It was quite an interesting experience. So when we are empowered by the Lord to do something, we keep that awareness that I am empowered. And Krishna can withdraw this at any time. You know, Hanuman, who jumps over the ocean and sets fire to Lanka, and he's very aware that he's empowered. Arjuna, who said, you know, I was able to go through this great ocean of sharks. And the next thing Prabhupada talks about is prayers. By the mercy of the Lord, even a layman can compose prayers of the highest spiritual perfection. You know, we have Keshava Kashmiri, who is very proud of his ability to compose prayers. But even Keshava Kashmiri was very aware that this power was not his, that it had come from the goddess Sarasvati, that he was empowered. And as soon as Sarasvati withdrew a little bit, and then his prayers were full of various faults. So Srila Prabhupada will sometimes say the prayers of Narottama Das Thakur, the prayers of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, are taken on the same level as the Shastra. Even Bhaktivinoda Thakur's prayers, they're composed in simple Bengali language, but still they have the same value as the greater value, we could say, than the prayers of the Rig Veda, for example. I was talking with one of my grandchildren the other day about poetry. She had written a little poem and was talking to me about it, how it rhymed. And I said, well, it rhymes, but it doesn't have the proper meter. It doesn't really have any meter. Well, what's a meter, she said. So we started talking about literary ornaments. She was studying about similes and metaphors and so forth. So really good poetry. You know, at Bhakti Godhead magazine, we frequently get poems submitted, and our editor-in-chief very rarely runs any of them. So to be good poetry, to have the proper meter, the proper rhyme, the proper syllabication, to have literary ornaments, simile, metaphor, alliteration, consonants, assonance, personification, hyperbole, and so forth and so on. That is rare to find somebody who's that gifted, you know, who does some poem that endures for decades or centuries, you know, the classics of poetry. Robert Louis Stevenson talking about, you know, the tree, or the poem about the tiger burning, with eyes burning bright in the night. The poem of the highwayman, the raven, all these very famous poems in the Western society. And how many people can write poetry like this? It's interesting, in modern society, I remember reading about that poetry seems to be dying. It used to be that people would read poems. Now, this was before mass media, when people wanted some entertainment in the evening. I mean, I remember growing up in my home that my parents would read books of poetry out loud in the evening. I think it's very rare that families will do anything like this. And the article I was reading said that they felt that modern music was now the... This was an article we were discussing in Back to Godhead in reference to whether or not we would print poetry. I think Judah Karmapu was distributing it, that modern music had replaced poetry for the people in general. You know, a lot of the music, it also has rhythm and rhyme and literary ornaments. Of course, some modern music is really just trash. But to be able to produce such things, to be able to produce beautiful poetry, whether just spoken or sung, requires a tremendous amount of talent. It doesn't require less talent than painting a Renaissance-level oil painting or winning some sports competition, playing classical music, something like that. But here, Prabhupada says that even an ordinary person, even someone not trained, we have the example of Dhruva Maharaj. Dhruva Maharaj was a 5-year-old boy. He hadn't even attended school. You know, my granddaughter, who was asking me about poetry, she's already 10. And, oh, well, what's a literary ornament? What's a simile? What's a metaphor? Well, we can guess that Dhruva Maharaj had no idea of these things. He didn't know about meter. He didn't know about rhyme. He didn't know about literary ornaments. And as soon as he was touched with the conch shell of the Lord, then he composed the most beautiful poetry. The gopis, the songs of the gopis in separation, are some of the top poetry anywhere in the world. They have internal and external rhymes. And again, all of the literary ornaments. By external understanding, the gopis are uneducated. Krishna didn't go to school until he left Vrindavan, till he went to be with Vasudeva and Devaki. It didn't seem that the village children had much of an education. Although the acharyas do talk about the gopis and the gopas writing letters, so they obviously had some sort of basic education. But they weren't really that educated. And still they were writing this beautiful poetry. Real poetry comes from the depths of the soul. It comes from our emotional experience. And so when the devotee is having emotional experiences in love of God, they naturally come out as beautiful prayers and poetry, and the Lord relishes them, even if they're imperfectly composed. So the devotees may write beautiful prayers that rival anything of Edgar Allan Poe or Robert Louis Stevenson or on that level. But even if the devotee's prayers are imperfectly composed, even if there's no meter and there's no rhyme and there's not a single literary ornament, still the heartfelt words of the devotee are better than the best literary prayers without that. Like the parents, they're very thrilled that the little child is trying to speak, even though so imperfect. And then Prabhupada talks about sincere endeavor. Spiritual perfection is not limited by material qualifications, but is developed by dint of one's sincere endeavor to render transcendental service. Again, we have this concept of transcendental service. And people ask all the time, what is sincerity? What does it mean to be sincere? How do you know that someone is sincere? Well, usually sincere, we mean not duplicitous. I mean, it's genuine. A sincere endeavor, a genuine endeavor, an authentic endeavor. So duplicitous can mean that there's some other motive, there's something else going on. I'm not doing my work with sincerity, I'm doing my work in a scheming way. Of course, the British use scheming in a different way. I'm doing my work with some nefarious, malevolent purpose. You know, some undercover police officer pretends to be a criminal, but they're not sincerely a criminal. They have some other motive. You know, some spy goes to the enemy's country and gets a job working in a clothing store, but they're not a sincere employee of the clothing store. They don't care about the profit of the clothing store. They're there for some other purpose. So sincerity means that it's genuine. Are you a sincere friend? And also means genuine in terms of the effort. He says a sincere endeavor. You know, sometimes a person will say, well, I tried, but, you know, what kind of a try was it? I tried for 5 minutes and then I gave up as soon as there was an obstacle. You know, I have a friend who will often claim to have tried things, but tries them only, you know, once or tries them for an hour. And I'll say, you have to try things, you have to work at things with some sustained endeavor. The research is that to become expert in anything generally takes at least 10,000 hours of working at it. Well, that's the kind of sincerity. Am I willing to put in the time and the effort to do it right and master whatever I am doing? Am I doing it without duplicity? So I would say those two things are the main measure of sincerity. Am I really trying to do the thing that I am appearing to do, or am I doing the thing as a cover for something else? And am I putting my best effort into what I'm doing? And of course, we can quibble about what is best effort, and best would mean best according to the time, place, and circumstance that I am in. and best according to my realization, not best on some absolute platform. I'm not going to be able to put, you know, the best possible endeavor is only done by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself. I can't endeavor at that platform, but I can do what's best for me and what's best for me now in terms of my sincere endeavor. And of course, sincerity always starts with just showing up. I give this example all the time. You're going to teach a class in something and you want sincere students. How do you know people are sincere? Well, first of all, I have to just be there. You know, just like there's a lot of statistics that people make resolutions, especially January 1st, beginning of the year, I'm going to join a gym and do exercise and get in shape. And so they go out and spend a lot of money on gym membership and they never show up to work out at the gym. Very common. A lot of the ways that these gymnasiums make their money is by people getting memberships that they don't use. So the first thing with sincerity, of course, is showing up. And then our last thing, which is the most important and ties everything together, voluntary endeavor. So we're doing something. We're doing some service. We're engaging in some of the 64 angas, limbs of devotional service. We are following the guru within, the guru without. We're making some effort that is sincere. And we're doing it voluntarily. We talked in the beginning about a living entity. The living entity has volition, has free will. Without our endeavor being voluntary, it is not very meaningful. It also can't be very sincere. Now, of course, when you're raising children, you have to say to the children, say thank you, say please, you know, brush your teeth. And the children are doing it because it's the rules of the parents. They're not really doing it voluntarily. So it may be that one who starts in Vaidhi Bhakti is following the orders of the scriptures. In other words, it's not that it's something, the specific something is what they would have done. So someone who says, I want to realize God, the desire to sit down with beads and chant for a couple hours a day, that particular desire may not have come from their heart. However, they're still choosing to do that chanting on the order of Guru because they want to attain love of God. Therefore, it is still voluntary. In one sense, practically everything that we do is voluntary. Even if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, do this or I'll shoot you, you're still choosing to do that activity rather than being shot. And you can say, well, that's not much of a choice, but there are people who choose to be shot. I mean, I know in the concentration camps in the Holocaust, there were people who were told, you know, if you help the Jews, then we'll kill you. They said, well, then go ahead and kill me. So Srila Prabhupada wrote that letter where he says, everything has to be individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. The purpose is to keep, that management was to keep the spirit of enthusiastic service, which is individual, spontaneous, and voluntary. If we lose that sense of voluntary, if we start feeling that we're being forced, if we start feeling that we're acting against our will, then we're losing this connection with the Lord in the heart. We're losing our empowerment. As much as one can lose one's empowerment by being proud and by taking the credit for oneself, one can also lose one's empowerment if we have a feeling of being forced or manipulated. There's a devotee who recently left Krishna consciousness and became particularly angry at his spiritual master, and he was writing extensively about his experiences. And much of his anger was that he felt that the experience gradually became forced, that it gradually became a manipulative experience where he no longer felt that his own volition, his own free will was involved. And that sense of having his voluntary free will violated was so distasteful to him that he, practically speaking, became an atheist. Not only did he say, well, I don't want to serve my guru, or I don't want to serve in my guru's ashram, and not only did he say, I'm not interested in Krishna consciousness, but he said, I'm no longer interested in God. I'm no longer interested in anything spiritual. It's such a sacred thing, remembering that everyone is a volunteer, always, even materially speaking. I mean, we're forced in the sense that our bodies have to eat and breathe, but still, people can fast. And there are people who fasted for some political motive. But we are all volunteers. And keeping that spirit of voluntary, finding the voluntary. I have a friend who's very wealthy and gives a lot of donations to various spiritual causes. So he was part of a team that was funding a new project. One of the team members had promised very large sums of money in the millions and reneged on his promise. He didn't give the money. So then this other person, this friend of mine, said to me, well, I had to make up the difference. I said to my friend, well, you didn't have to, you chose to. And it's far better to think of things in terms of voluntary choice than to think of things in terms of should and have. And he said, no, I didn't choose to, I had to. I said, all right, but you had to because you wanted to. And there was some want there. He said, no, if I think it's voluntary, I won't do it anymore. So I thought that was quite interesting. He said, if I think that I have a choice here, I won't do it. If we're in that kind of a situation where we say, the only way to get myself to do something is to try to obliterate the very real truth that I have a choice, then we're putting ourselves into a situation that's not only false, but is going to be very uncomfortable. So there was something he was choosing there. Maybe he didn't like having to give that much money, but maybe what he was choosing was to uphold the reputation of the local temple. That was a kind of a complex situation. Maybe he was choosing to benefit the people who were going to be in the project and so forth. So there was something there that he was choosing. Maybe he was choosing just to be a good, moral, ethical person. I don't know. But we should find where we're choosing. With everything that we're doing, picking up our japa beads, taking care of the deities, reading the shastras, anything that we're doing, we should look at it and say, this is a choice. And then one can say, well, what about addictions? So addictions start with a choice. And as that choice becomes habitual, said something like at least 40 to 50% of everything we do every day is simply habit. That our volition is not so much involved anymore. So a habit, and then a habit gets to the point where starts controlling us. When someone has an addiction, their habits have controlled them, and their sense of volition to change the habit seems very small. But of course, with great endeavor, habits can be changed. Even the most destructive and difficult habits, even habits that involve a chemical dependency in the body, can be changed. So many examples of people who've given up all kinds of habits, whatever kind it may be. So to find our free will, to find our volition, and to focus on that. Where is my desire? Where is my free will? To relish that, not to think of ourselves as being forced or should or have to, because that is our only qualification for spiritual perfection. Our material acquisition, our material talents, those are all very temporary and external. They're not really ours. But our voluntary desires, those are ours. Those are ours. Those are not given by someone else. They cannot be taken away by someone else. They're not something artificial. So having the desire to serve, listening to the Lord within, giving Krishna credit for all the wonderful things he empowers us to do, becoming expert in prayers, having a sincere endeavor, and really focusing on this aspect of being voluntary, and then we attain perfection, which is what we are all here for. So, questions, comments?
Thank you very much, Urmila Prabhu, about bringing up choice. Because, a lot of times I think, devotees will think, well, I have to do this. And then it becomes a chore. like, you know, chanting our rounds or, you know, doing any particular service. And it's so nice to be reminded that, you know, really it is our choice. And then it becomes blissful.
Yes.
I feel. And now I just haven't thought of it that way. And I think maybe some devotees can get burnt out when they feel that they are, you know, they have to do this.
Yes.
And so I just really thank you for that. It's just very enlightening.
Oh, thank you. Of course, there's consequences often for not doing things or doing things, but it's still we choose to do that thing rather than get the consequence. It's still a choice. Somebody else?
Mother, well, you talked a lot about empowerment in performing our devotional service. Really important subject. I have to confess that sometimes in the course of the fury of engaging in devotional service, it's often I may have a tendency to forget. I know that, like, for example, this last Saturday we had a gathering here and we were posted in a local magazine. They featured an article about the gatherings we were having, so we had about no less than 45 new guests that
wow.
had never heard that we're not the body, that human life is meant exclusively for self-realization. And they were, you know, all assembled in our temple room with, like, all ears. And I remember before I spoke, I prayed to Prabhupada to please empower me to speak. And then I announced to them that what I would be presenting was not coming from me. I'm just a conduit, that this is all coming from the great acharyas, the great spiritual masters, hopefully through me. And I take no credit. But then in speaking for about an hour, it's hard to not feel that you're speaking, that it's easy to forget that we're being empowered. And I know that to whatever degree we try to grab the credit, our false ego tries to sneak in and take credit. To that degree, it will weaken the potency of the transcendental sound vibration that we are vibrating.
Yes,
and of course, at the end, I prayed to Prabhupada, you know, for, you know, the blessing me to be able to speak. But I do have to confess that in the middle, it's hard for that to keep that false ego from contaminating. And so my question is, how do we do that? How do we, when we're in the fury of the fire of serving, how do we try to be pure like that and really acknowledge the empowerment that it's 100% not coming from us?
To relishly find your taste and happiness in that feeling of empowerment. You know what empowerment feels like, yes? There's a certain feeling. Yes?
It's a wonderful feeling.
Okay. So you know what that feeling is, right?
I do, but it can be intoxicating.
Oh, it's very intoxicating. Allow yourself to be intoxicated by the feeling of empowerment.
Okay.
Mm. Relish it.
That's a bona fide intoxication.
Absolutely. And then the happiness of I'm the doer will automatically, param jistvam nivartate. Then the happiness that I'm the doer will just seem like old stale bread in comparison to kachoris with tamarind sauce or whatever it is that floats your boat. The happiness of empowerment is very intoxicating. I mean, the happiness I felt that evening at O'Hare Airport was just phenomenal. You know, you just wanted to get that again and again and again. And you didn't want to go back to thinking, I'm the doer, I'm so great. You know, I'm the doer, I'm so great. What do they call it? Pretender syndrome or something? You know, we always know I'm not, really. It's a sham. Right? All the time, if you're thinking, I'm the doer, I'm so great, there's another little voice going, no, you're not. What if people knew this about you and this about you and this about you? Right?
Yes.
It's miserable. It's filled with fear. Maybe I'll be exposed that actually I'm just a flaming, incompetent idiot. And then nobody will love me anymore, or whatever, you know. I'll lose my job because I'll find that I'm really incompetent. It's just filled with fear. It's not pleasant. Whereas the feeling of being empowered is amazing. It's wonderful. And you get to be astonished. You get to have all this, at least for myself, all this kind of adbhuta rasa, you know, just astonished at how Krishna's using you. Just like Kardama Muni, you know, he made that aerial city and he was just astonished. How did I do that? It's so much fun. Thinking that I am the doer is terrifying. It's just terrifying. What do I do? Maybe I'll mess up. Maybe everyone will find out that I'm just simply a materialistic demon. You know? And then everything will be ruined. So it's filled with fear and pretense and manipulation and it's awful. All right, so you get this little taste of pride. And you get this little taste from the adulation of others. Right? There's something. There's something. Like I was reading Paul McCartney said he wanted to keep performing the rest of his life because he got such a, you know, high from the audience reciprocation. So there's something in performing. Everyone's performing. But compared to the happiness of being empowered, the happiness of being a performer is nothing. It's, oh yeah, like you're saying, Khandita, it's so dry. And it leaves you at the mercy of the people who are, you know, honoring you and respecting you. You become their slave. And they're not very good masters. If you've had that experience, they can turn on you at any moment. Whereas when you're empowered, you're Krishna's servant. And yeah, you just delight in how Krishna is using you. So allow yourself. We're an Anandamaya Vyasat. We're pleasure-seeking beings. So we have to voluntarily, we have to give ourselves permission to dive deeply into a spiritual pleasure. Now, at first, we'll be doing it for our own pleasure. So it's really more like sattva-gun than bhakti. At first we'll just say, wow, this pleasure of empowerment is so much better than the pleasure of being the doer, which is rajagun and tamagun. But it's still about my pleasure. But it's a whole lot better to be enjoying sattvagun than rajagun and tamagun. It's much better to be doing bhakti and sattvagun. Jayapataka Swami compares sattva-gun to the airport. You're not on the plane, you know, but you're at least in the place where you can catch the plane. Even the stage of ruchi in sadhana bhakti, there's still a contamination in the heart in ruchi. But one is relishing the service. After ruchi, one relishes Krishna directly, rather than relishing the service. So in ruchi, one's relishing, wow, Krishna's empowering me in such a cool way. Oh, I'm so much enjoying doing this service, being empowered, woohoo! And in a shakti, you're looking past the empowerment to the person. Well, Krishna's wonderful. I'm really relishing Krishna, whether he empowers me or not. Whatever service I'm doing, I'm really relishing Krishna. It's not still, there's still some me in there. But a shakti is a stepping stone to bhava, and in bhava, one is simply thinking about serving the Lord. One starts relishing Krishna so much that one's own happiness becomes insignificant. It's already included. It becomes a given. Now, if you have good parents, you don't worry about whether there'll be food. Your focus is on enjoying being with your family, not whether or not you're going to get enough to eat. That recedes into the background because you know you're going to get enough to eat. So there's so much happiness in Ruchi and Ashakti that the jiva stops thinking about that. It's just there. And their thoughts then turn to just pleasing Krishna. But if you don't allow yourself to dive into that happiness of Ruchi, how will one get to Ashakti and Bhava? And then there's always the danger that we will, because we have to get some happiness, then there's always the danger that we'll look for the other kinds, which is so boring and dangerous. Yes, Radhana Rupini.
Hare Krishna, Mataji.
Hare Krishna.
You were talking about the, you know, how we do things voluntarily. Well, I just wanted to tell you something that I've just been through. Mm. I have this beautiful young lady that's come to stay with me since January. Unfortunately, her guru was very rigid and difficult with her to the point where she has to be disconnected. And, you know, she hears the music in the house. She sees me doing my thing. And I don't, you know, I have a friendship with her, and she talks to me about angels, and I will sit down and listen about the angels, because then I feel like we're establishing a friendship and a bond. And, but lately, I've been noticing, like, from the beginning, every time I open up my altar, she'll pay her obeisance.
Mm.
Or we're both in the kitchen, and she is a vegan. We're both in the kitchen, and I'm cooking, and I'm going to make an offering. She'll say, "Oh, could you offer my buckwheat also?"
Mm-hmm.
And so I would do that. And then just recently, I'm sitting in my table. My kitchen table is full of deity stuff. I'm creating a new outfit for all my deities. And she decided to sit down there and talk with me, and she's drinking her smoothie, watching me, and I'm asking her, "What do you think about this? And what do you think about this?" You know, how I'm sewing. And she's giving me, and the next thing you know, she brings her iPhone out and starts to show me her deity.
Mm.
And she's starting to remember. And, you know, they're beautiful. I said, "Where are they?" "They're in the suitcase." And I said, "Oh, they're sleeping, I see." She says, she said, "What should I do?" I said, "Well, for now, maybe you could take a picture and put them on your altar until you're ready." But it's like she started speaking about them, and all this memory started coming up, and I could see the transformation in her face. And she'd tell me about the deity worship and her clothes, and there's this and there's that. And I was listening, and it was just amazing how Krishna does that.
Yes. Yes.
It's just amazing how Krishna does that. She left like she was not even touching the ground when she left to go do her work that day. And it's just all by, you know, voluntary.
Yes.
Again, it wasn't like it was being forced, or it was just something it was voluntary, and then Krishna just arranged where she would, these floods of memories and good memories, because she did voice to me all the bad memories one night. We stayed up till 1 o'clock in the morning. She was talking to me, and I had to listen to all of it because she needed to let it out, you know?
Right.
But it's beautiful how that happens when you allow it to be voluntary and you just are kind and loving to people, and then, you know, it just kind of happens.
Very nice.
And I just wanted to share that because it was really a beautiful thing.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Radhana Rupini. Anybody else?
I have a question if you have time.
Sure.
Okay. When you were giving your description about distributing books and being empowered, how'd you say? at no time did I feel like you were proud of it, you know, so I felt that you also felt like you were empowered. But when you hear other devotees, sometimes it's difficult because you can tell that they want to be glorified, you know, for their devotional activities. I remember I was listening to a recording once, and Srila Prabhupada was talking to an Indian man, and he was just going on and on about his preaching. And it's kind of like scratching a blackboard, you know, it's hard to hear. So my question is how to have the proper mentality, because I'm sure it's my own contamination that I feel, you know, like if somebody is proud that, you know, I don't like to hear it.
Well, this so, desire to be glorified and to be honored for being a spiritual person is, according to Raghunath Das Goswami in Manashiksha, the last anarta that's given up. And even people who, according to Raghunath Das Goswami, are swimming in an ocean of love with a jewel of love of God may still have this desire for honor in the heart. So even people whose activities are all pure, they're preaching to help others. They're not preaching for getting money or for attracting the opposite sex. They're not envious of materialistic persons. They're not engaged in any gross sinful activities. Their hearing and chanting is all about the Lord. They don't talk about material things or liberation. Even for those people, he compares it that in the heart, there's a dancing woman who's disloyal, she's unchaste, she's impure, and she is eating dog meat. And the dog meat is honor, and the woman represents the desire for honor. When we have a desire for honor, we're not loyal. We go to whoever will give us honor. And he says the cure is to serve the great generals and the army of Krishna's devotees. In other words, to honor and serve those who are really honorable and worthy of service. It helps us to relieve ourselves of our desire to be honored and served. But this tendency, my point is that this tendency remains in some way or another, at some extent or another, until the end. So if we're not swimming in Krishna prema, even if we are swimming in the ocean of love, because what's interesting is when one gets rid of this unchaste woman in the heart, the next step in Manashiksha is one drinks love, that the chaste ladies of love enter the heart, and one is drinking the shining nectar, the ujwala amrita of love, that love fills one internally, not just externally. We can assume, if we know honestly that we're not at the highest levels of bhakti, that this desire for honor, and specifically being honored for our purity and honored for our devotion, is present within us. As we advance, we become more and more aware. Bhaktivedanta Swami talks about this quite a lot, that we become more and more aware not only of our own anarthas, but in the process of being more sensitized and aware of our own anarthas, we become simultaneously more aware of others. And the downside of that is it makes it easier to be offensive to others. It makes it easier to criticize others, to harm others, because their faults jump out at us because of our heightened awareness and our heightened consciousness. And yes, it can be very difficult, especially if people are covered by many things. It can be very difficult to hear them or be around them because the desire to be honored is so prevalent in them. But do keep in mind that being able to see this within oneself is quite difficult. It's something that's happening in the heart. It's not something external, like, you know, going to stripping nightclubs or something. It's drinking alcohol. It's not you know, if someone's drinking alcohol, oh, okay, so smoking cigarettes, you know, I'm doing something really wrong. I hope people drinking alcohol, smoking marijuana know they're doing something really wrong. I don't know. You never know what anybody knows nowadays. But with this desire for honor, it's so subtle. Raghunath Goswami says it's a the woman is dancing in the heart. So the person feels, oh, there's a kind of a party going on in my heart. You know, they're surrounded in this ocean of love of God, which is all, of course, external, but they're swimming in this ocean, and there's this party going on in their heart, and they think, yes, I am a great devotee. They don't recognize that the party is serving dog meat, and the people who are dancing are unclean and disloyal. And getting this dancing, unchaste woman and her dead dog out of the heart, it's not an easy thing. You know, when Jesus wanted to get the money sellers out of the temple, he was pretty aggressive about it. It's not an easy thing. Without asking for the generals, without serving the generals in the Lord's army, we're not going to get rid of her. We're certainly not going to get rid of her by our own endeavor. So keeping all this in mind, we want to follow what the Ishopanishad says. And one should know sat and asat, sambutim, asambutim, side by side. I really like Madhurya Kadambini, how there's this going up and down. So you start out with no God consciousness and all false ego consciousness, and gradually Atnista becomes about equal, and gradually, but even here there's still some me consciousness. See people side by side. Yes, this person just wants honor. What do they want honor for? They want honor for serving the Lord. They don't want honor for, you know, just eradicating malaria. They don't want honor for, you know, this demoniac Donald Trump guy. You know, they don't want honor for opening casinos. They don't want honor for being a good family man. They don't want honor for being rich. They want honor for their service. Just see that. Yes, the desire for honor is still there, but at least they want to be honored for their service. They want to be honored for something in relationship to Krishna. And that relationship to Krishna, if they keep going, will eventually overpower and eradicate their desire for honor, and eventually they'll become humble. And unless we're that person's guru or parent, just give them the honor, you know.
Well,
we used to do that all the time in temples. Here's your, you know, you distributed 600 books, guy. Here's your maha plate. You know, some compassion. And it'll go. Now, of course, if somebody's overwhelmingly like that, then maybe you don't hang out with them all the time. Better to hang out with the humble devotees. Yes, Vidakta Madhava Prabhu.
Haribol?
Yes.
Okay. You just kind of got me going here. When Srila Srila Maharaj Prabhupada visited Srila Srila Maharaj, his greeting was, "It's wonderful to see Krishna working through someone." That was hello.
Mm.
And then Prabhupada said, he got emotional, and he said, "It's all due to the mercy of our spiritual master."
Mm.
He didn't take credit. So, in the early days, you know, I remember I was attracted by some of the paintings. It was one of the things that attracted me to the movement. And then when I came in the Association of Devotees, I realized that Jadarani, who had painted some amazing paintings, you know, around the third canto, you know, second to third canto, I saw her early stuff, and it was like childlike.
Yes.
It was like... And suddenly, she's painting like a master. She's painting beyond her own ability.
Yes.
So she found a way,
you know, she found a way to transcend it. And it's not that it was a gradual thing. It was almost like overnight.
Yes.
It wasn't like, you know, it took, you know? And then I meet this guy in Boston. He's got, you know, glasses. He looks very nerdy. He's very introverted. His name was Shivananda. And, you know, he was a nice guy. But then somebody told me after I met him that he had opened Germany. You know, and it was just, I couldn't even put that together, how this man opened Germany. So in the early days, people were very much aware, I think, the devotees were very much aware that they were being empowered by Prabhupada. Prabhupada was empowered, and he was empowering others. And I think some of that has been lost over time, that, you know, this idea, this desire for honor, you know, people are a little opaque, and they're not completely, you know, it's like the Vyasa Puja of Puri Maharaj. I remember, you know, he you can see he's just giving everything to his guru. He's not accepting what the, you know, the honor he's getting that day. Same with Bodhayan Maharaj. And that's the only way you can do it, you know. People are coming up with garland after garland after garland, just praising you like crazy, and you just give it to, you just lay it at the feet of your guru. That's how you get out of that. So, you know, and then your point about, you know, you become aware of your own anarthas, and then you start seeing them in others. Well, wouldn't that just make you humble? You know, just, oh, he's got what I got.
Yeah, well, it should. It should, you know. Unfortunately, sometimes it just makes us annoyed and repulsed. But if we remember that the reason I'm so sensitive to this in others is that it's something that I also am dealing with, or even if it's something I have dealt with in the past. I mean, even if it's an anartha we no longer have. I remember I was in the Middle East and someone asked, how do I deal with non-devotee relatives and friends? It's a question you get a lot. And at first I had the feeling that this is just an inconsequential question. Why do people care so much about this? Why is it such a big deal? And then immediately I remember that there was a time when that was my question, when that was the overwhelming big question for me. So even if you no longer have that problem, someone says, you know, like if you had to give up smoking and someone else says, how do I give up smoking? Well, you don't smoke anymore. You can still remember and have compassion and have some humility that I only got out of this problem by the grace of God. It's not that I got out of this problem because I'm so clever or I'm still dealing with this problem. It's getting kind of late. Mahalakshmi, if it's a question with a quick answer, sure, go ahead. Mahalakshmi? Oh, we hear a kirtan. Mahalakshmi, do you have a question?
She should be able to unmute herself.
You say, what does it mean? I don't know what it is.
Okay. Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna.
Hare Krishna, thank you for your class. My question is, what does it mean not to allow oneself to dive in roots?
What, not to allow oneself to what?
To dive in ruchi.
Well, we condition souls, we want Krishna, at the same time we may be hesitant. You know? So sometimes, if there's some great happiness in devotional service, we may back off from it. Narahariprabhu was describing a situation where he starts off feeling empowered and then it fades. So that may be due to his not accepting it and relishing it. I mean, I've met devotees who are afraid to relish their service because they think, well, then I'll be getting some sense enjoyment out of my service. So we also have to voluntarily embrace the happiness of devotional service. It's the only way to get rid of the lower happinesses. Is that clear?
Because I am making noise. Yes.
Or just, you know, let's take a material example. So a person can eat delicious food and not even be aware that they're eating. In fact, people who have gained a lot of weight often eat unconsciously. They don't really even enjoy the food they're eating. They're often not even aware of how it tastes. They're eating automatically. It's very easy to sit down to eat and not enjoy the taste of the food. Yes? Is that correct?
Yes.
The food may be very tasty, but your consciousness is elsewhere. Your thoughts are elsewhere. To enjoy the food, you have to really think about what you're eating. So we can do that in Krishna consciousness also, in spiritual life also. We can be doing some service where there's great spiritual happiness in the service, but we're not allowing ourselves to be aware of it and to experience it. So the happiness of empowerment is so much greater than the happiness of thinking oneself is the doer, that if we allow ourselves to relish it, we won't be interested in the lower happiness. Thank you very much, Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.